That mind, Tehran hosting a conference of Afghan neighbors. Iran says Afghanistan needs to install a government that is all-inclusive. 200 Turkish military vehicles now deployed in Idlib just hours after Turkey's parliament gives a green light to the extension of cross-border operations in Syria and Iraq. Plus, COVID on the rise in Europe, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, and Hungary witnessing their highest daily infections. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this AFO, a one-day conference of Afghan neighbors that kicked off in Tehran hours ago is right now continuing behind closed doors. In his opening address, Iran's foreign minister held the U.S. responsible for the current problems in Afghanistan.
The crisis worrying all of us today is the result of unwarranted interference by oppressive powers, specifically the U.S. occupation of and intervention in Afghanistan and West Asia over the past two decades. 20 years ago, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism and escalated instability, war, poverty, and displacement there with its continued military presence.
At the heart of this conference is a central issue of an inclusive government that represents all Afghan ethnic groups. This is a key concern of all participating countries, as reflected in the speeches made by Iran's foreign ministers, as well as those of top diplomats from China, Tajikistan, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Russia. The participating states say international cooperation is needed for restoring stability to Afghanistan and safeguarding the rights of its people. UN Chief Antonio Guterres also virtually addressed the conference and called for a unified approach towards the crisis in Afghanistan. He said the future government must guarantee security and compliance with the international law and human rights. The conference will close with a final statement. Our correspondent spoke with Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh on the sidelines of the Tehran conference. He told us that the participating countries are pursuing active diplomacy to ensure Afghanistan will be a peaceful and prosperous nation in the not-too-distant future.
We are in a very critical situation regarding Afghanistan. What is happening right now in Tehran is an attempt by all six neighboring countries of Afghanistan to work together for the peaceful and prosperous Afghanistan in near future. What we are seeing right now in Tehran is an active diplomacy trying to bring together all different factions of thoughts about the future of Afghanistan to clarify what are the main principles that everybody can agree on. We are trying to show that all neighboring countries of Afghanistan can work together for a better better future for Afghanistan, and trying to materialize the will of the people of Afghanistan, whom they are actually subject to this critical situation. What we are seeing right now is the very catastrophic ramifications of United States invasion of Afghanistan, and this irresponsible runaway of the of Washington. What we are doing right now is trying to actually bring together the different players who can actually have an effective role, and Tehran is a place that we hope that we can provide a better ground for the next round, which is going to happen in Beijing soon.
Earlier, author and geopolitical analyst Greg Simons shared with us his views about the importance of the Tehran conference.
The fact that this conference has taken place illustrates the declining power and influence of the Western-centric U.S. unipolar order, and the rise of influence and power of this non-Western-centric multipolar order within global politics and international relations. And this case of Afghanistan is yet another critical test to consolidate this transformation of global geopolitics. And if we look at Afghanistan itself, it's not only a matter of Afghani security and stability, because Afghanistan's security and stability also has wider implications for Eurasia. the neighboring countries and even beyond. And the United States does know this.
We're learning from a source present at the Brussels talks that Tehran has indeed expressed its readiness to hold talks with the three European countries on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. The source tells us that Iran has officially invited France, the UK, and Germany to get together for a meeting in Tehran, or one of the capital cities of the E3, but the European sides have not yet responded. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bavadikani is currently in Brussels to meet with the EU coordinator of the Joint Commission on the deal. Reports have emerged claiming that the Iranian representative has refused to meet and hold talks with three European representatives. Petrol stations in Iran are gradually returning to normal after a cyber attack disrupted the smart card system used to buy subsidized fuel at pumps. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme Council of Cyberspace says experts investigating the incident have come across signs of a cyber attack. Abul Hassan Firouzabadi noted the attack was probably carried out by a foreign country with the aim of disrupting public services. Earlier, Iranian oil ministry officials reported a gradual return of fuel stations to full functionality. They also stated that nearly 50% of the country's petrol stations were already selling fuel at unsubsidized rates through cash payments, despite the incident. Earlier, we were joined by political commentator Daniel Azar, who gave us his thoughts on the cyber attack that disrupted fuel stations in Iran.
I mean, my first suspicion is that it'd be Israel, because Israel has a capability, and Israel is clearly out to harass Iran at every opportunity. But Iran has other enemies in the region, and it's possible that they're involved instead. So I really can't be sure who is behind these attacks. This is really an important development. I mean, cyber security, cyber vulnerability is very important. And a wide range of actors are using cyber attacks to harass governments they don't like. And it's often difficult to attribute them to any one actor. So, and that way they're kind of ideal. It's a way of causing damage and being able to hide your own responsibility. So that makes it especially troublesome, and I assume that other countries will face these attacks as well. And Iran seems to be especially vulnerable at this time, but it's very hard to sort of figure out what's going on here.
Turkey has started deploying 200 military vehicles to Idlib in northwestern Syria just hours after its parliament extended a military mandate for cross-border operations in Syria and Iraq. The convoy is said to be loaded with weapons. Ankara is saying the escalations near its southern border are behind the parliament's decision. The motion allows the Turkish military to call out operations against groups that Ankara deems as terrorists. That includes Kurdish militias in the rest of the region. Syria and Iraq are both opposed to the presence of Turkish troops on their soil. They say the move violates their sovereignty. The operations have strained Ankara's relations with Damascus and Baghdad. Muhammad Ali says Turkey's military buildup in Idlib is to protect the remnants of terrorists there from a sudden Syrian army offensive.
Turkey has a large number of armored vehicles inside Syria. It carried out military operations in violation of Syria's sovereignty and international law without any UN mandate. Also, it's very important to say that this comes after the Turkish parliament approved to the government having cross-border operations for the next couple of years. This has been happening since 2013. However, many analysts here say that this is not the decision of Turkey. This is a violation of an independent country. And we also know that, according to many analysts here, why Turkey is doing that, why it is sending more and more reinforcements, it seems, according to the analysts here in Damascus, that Turkey is fearing a sudden offensive by the Syrian army against the remaining terrorist groups in Idlib. Finally, it's important to say that Idlib is the last and largest stretch of land in Syria that terrorists occupy, and they do get the direct support from Turkey for years.
The Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit, known as Hashd al-Shaabi, is denying reports that the place where a deadly attack happened just a day ago was under the group's security watch. The PMU says it's prepared to assume control of the area in case the Joint Operations Command agrees with the decision. Gunmen armed with automatic weapons stormed a village in the eastern province of Diyala. Nearly a dozen people were killed and 15 others injured in the shooting spree. No claim of responsibility until this hour, but security officials are blaming the bloodshed on Daesh terrorists, saying Civilians were the main target. New revelations have surfaced showing the lengths the highest officials in Saudi Arabia are willing to go to consolidate their power. In their quest to suppress dissent, they don't discriminate between former government officials and human rights activists.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also referred to as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, target squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back to Saudi Arabia.
A psychopath with no empathy, doesn't feel emotion, never learned from his experience. And we have witnessed atrocities and crimes committed by this killer. And the warning I received, don't be in a proximity of any Saudi mission in Canada. Don't go to the consulate, don't go to the embassy. Said why? Said they dismembered the guy, they kill him. You are at the top of the list.
Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
Well, I would say that Mohammed bin Salman, the supposed Saudi crown prince, never really goes to school and learns any kind of lesson whatsoever. He got away with murdering Khashoggi in Turkey, and the Americans huffed and puffed, and the intelligence services said that he was most likely involved, that the Saudis were definitely involved, and nothing was done about it.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018.
Saudi Arabia has a long track record of crushing dissent and silencing the opposition, but the crackdown has especially escalated since 2017 when de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman was appointed the crown prince. The cold-blooded killing of Saudi critic Jamal Khashoggi 3 years ago stirred a lot of controversy, but even that has failed to keep the kingdom from committing human rights violations, including torturing dissidents and activists. All of this, of course, gives rise to a key question. What is it about the opposition that worries bin Salman?
From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confine of its borders. As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions of announcing the reforms in the first place. In the meantime, al-Jabri alleged in the interview that MBS had even mentioned his intention of assassinating Saudi Arabia's former King Abdullah, and that there is video evidence proving it.
That's what he said, whether he's just bragging, or but he said that, and we took it seriously.
Does this video recording still exist?
Yes. I know where it is now. I know there are two copies of that. I know where they are.
Well, the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is desperately afraid of Saad al-Jabri. Al-Jabri was in the interior ministry. He was the interior minister's right-hand man. And he knows where the bodies are buried and where the money went. He has been has stated, to my knowledge, that the king and his son, Mohammed bin Salman, have been dipping into the Saudi government funds more than what is being appropriated for them, which astonishingly is $800 million per month.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
Well, the UK is home to some of the world's biggest weapons manufacturers, among them Israel's Elbit Systems. Elsewhere, COVID outbreaks are seeing an uptick in some European countries just in the past week. Over 40 countries in the region have had an increase in the number of infections. Now the latest figures coming out of Bulgaria show more than 6,800 new daily infections, the highest since the beginning of the pandemic. Also more than 120 new fatalities, now bringing the overall total to over 23,400. Bulgaria is facing medical staff shortages and hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID patients. The country has the lowest vaccination rate in the EU. Meantime, the Czech Republic and Hungary have registered their highest daily infection tallies since April. The figure was above 6,200 in the Czech Republic and over 3,100 in Hungary. Germany downgrading its projected economic growth for 2021 as the nation struggles to rebound from a downturn due to the coronavirus pandemic. Europe's economic powerhouse is predicting that its economy would only expand by 2.6% this year. That's lower than the previously estimated 3.5%. Bottlenecks in the supply chain and shortages of raw materials are complicating Germany's post-pandemic recovery. This happens as Social Democrats are preparing to form a new government by December the 6th after winning last month's elections. Following Germany's growth forecast, European main stock markets opened lower on Wednesday. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September the 2nd, 2021. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praises due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with God on earth. You are very welcome, dear brothers. I congratulate all of you for the blessing to be present in the main centers of serving the people. God the Exalted has bestowed on you the blessing to be present in the main centers of serving the country, the nation, and the Islamic Republic. You should appreciate the value of this blessing. I also wish to thank the Islamic Consultative Majlis for having carried out its duties on time. I hope that this will be a good and auspicious beginning for you and the country. Government Week is ornamented with the names of Shahid Rajai and Shahid Bahonar. In other words, it is ornamented with the name and remembrance of martyrdom. God's mercy be upon those two great, outstanding and active men who were blessed with martyrdom. They truly intended to serve.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Although their term of service was short, they showed that they had entered the arena with purity and with the intention of rendering services. They had an Islamic popular and jihadi mentality. This is a lesson for all existing officials. You, dear brothers, have accepted your responsibility in a difficult time. I hope that God will help you. I too pray, and I hope that you succeed. These are difficult circumstances, considering the high rate of inflation, the people's livelihood problems, the issue of coronavirus, and the various other problems that exist. If on the one hand you work in a diligent, untiring, and round-the-clock way, and if you rely on God the Exalted as a reserve and as an investment, you will definitely win and succeed, and you will overcome problems. You should make your intentions divine. And divine intention in this position of yours means having the intention to serve the people. If you enter the field with the genuine intention of serving the people, this is a divine and pure intention, one that will become blessed by God.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The International Islamic Unity Conference is held annually in Tehran. The conference brings together Shia and Sunni scholars and intellectuals from around the world. On Sunday, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed Iranian officials and foreign participants at the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized the importance of unity. He stated that the reason for his repeated emphasis on this issue is the large divide that exists across faiths, with enemies attempting to increase it.
Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. tries to sow discord among Muslims by raising the issue of Sunni and Shia. Both Shia and Sunnis agree on most of the fundamental beliefs and practices of Islam. Their bitter divide goes back some 14 centuries. It began with disagreements about who should succeed the Prophet Muhammad as the leader of Islamic faith, but the two have coexisted despite the differences. Ayatollah Khamenei further said, "Unity among Muslims is a principal command by the Holy Quran and not a tactic dictated by circumstances." He added that a novel Islamic civilization can only be established when Shia and Sunni Muslims converge in a united front. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei also said that Palestine serves as the top criteria for unity in the Muslim world. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized certain regional states for normalizing relations with Israel, calling the approach sinful and wrong. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords at the White House in 2020 to normalize ties with the occupying Israeli regime. Morocco and Sudan later signed normalization agreements with Israel as well. Daesh has maintained a foothold in eastern and northeastern Afghanistan following the United States' hasty withdrawal from the country, which led to the collapse of the Afghan government and the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Daesh has claimed responsibility for several attacks against the Taliban recently. It has also targeted Shias in Syria and Iraq in the past. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, touched on the U.S. attempt to incite unrest among Islamic countries through its proxies. Ayatollah Khamenei blamed the U.S. for a recent wave of terrorist attacks by Daesh targeting Shia Muslim mosques in Afghanistan that killed scores of people. Ayatollah Khamenei said one method to prevent such incidents is for present Afghan leaders to visit Shia centers and mosques and urge Sunni Muslims to join interreligious congregations.
Yes. I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. has always been backing these mercenary terrorist networks such as the Daesh, and it serves their cause as long as the Muslim Ummah has disunity and there's this sedition and this hatred that is being bred inside the Islamic world, then they can easily control the region, take over the resources, build their bases, and secure their puppets that they have installed in place.
Ayatollah Khamenei urged Islamic countries to set aside their differences and stressed that unity among Muslims will create synergy and strengthen them in interacting with non-Islamic countries.
Israel seized large parts of Syria's Golan Heights during the Six-Day War of 1967. Most of the Syrian inhabitants had to flee the area. Syria tried to retake the occupied territory in 1973 in a surprise operation, but despite inflicting heavy losses on Israeli forces in that conflict, it failed to liberate Golan. The two sides signed an armistice the following year, and ever since, a United Nations observer force has been deployed on the ceasefire line. International law says Israel must withdraw its forces from the occupied Syrian territory and hand it over to Syria. But just like other parts of Israeli-occupied territories, such as the West Bank, Israel has been defying international law and has been building there. The Israeli regime unilaterally annexed Syria's Golan Heights in 1981, but the international community never recognized the move. In 2019, former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation officially recognizing the annexation, drawing condemnation from Syria and most of the world. Despite continued worldwide support for the liberation of the Heights, Israel seems to be planning to stay and expand its settlements there. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently that Israel will keep the territory. He also pledged to double the size of the Israeli settlers on the Golan, which is at around 20,000 in 30 settlements.
The regime has now decided to push ahead with a plan to build thousands of new settler units. Since taking office in June, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has sped up expansion of settlements, and the new Golan Project seems to be in line with his policy. Syria is infuriated by the regime's intensified violations in the occupied territory. Syria called on the United Nations Security Council this week to assume its responsibility and pile pressure on Israel to halt its illegal practices in the Golan Heights. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah, said Golan will return to the homeland sooner or later, and all the measures taken by the regime are null and void and have no legal effect. What can Syria and the international community do to push Israel to stop building on lands that international law says must be given back?
The only thing that can be done here is a policy of maximum pressure, either through armed resistance when you are in the region itself, like has been shown by the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, and various other groups surrounding the Zionist entity itself, or if you are a nation that is further away, through continued political pressure, through support to the Palestinian cause, and through economical sanctions.
Israel has been taking advantage of American support and the decision by some Arab states to normalize ties with Tel Aviv to advance its expansionist agenda. So it will not be easy to pile political pressure on Israel at the UN or in other international bodies. But grassroots campaigns like the increasingly popular boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel have managed to hurt Israel and raise awareness about its unending violations. The movement has targeted companies that are involved in Israeli settlement construction on occupied lands. The movement also encourages international boycott of products made or partly produced in Israeli settlements.
Well, I think the boycott, divest, and sanction movement is has shown to be a quite effective and efficient method, be it, of course, one of limited means in which we specifically only talk about boycotting Israeli products, but this has it has already yielded some fruit. We know this because the Zionist entity has been rapidly trying to ban and illegalize the BDS movement wherever it exists.
Any new settlement in the Golan Heights could be the next target of the BDS movement.
Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probing to Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shtayyeh called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hazem Qassem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel, despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violations of international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand
that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could, or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we're going to talk about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let's take a listen to a short biography.
The grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for the person who's like, having a piece of land as a mosque and either the sponsor or somebody who has it?
The trustee,
for example.
Yeah.
Is it permissible for that person to sell a part of the land which is or has been dedicated to the mosque to the municipality, all right? Given the fact that it is a piece of land endowed for the construction of the mosque?
A good question. Of course, we know that the waqf property is not permissible to sell. It's not allowed under any circumstances, no matter what excuse. To sell waqf property or an endowed property,
mm-hmm.
And it does not make any difference whether the property or the land, piece of land, is endowed for construction of a mosque, or it's dedicated for, let's say, for building an orphanage, or the waqf property can be private or public. It doesn't matter, and it's not permissible under any circumstances to sell a waqf property, a property or a piece of land that has been given as waqf.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, another question would be about the shrines of the imams and saints, all right?
Yeah.
What about these religious centers? Do the purity and impurity rules applying to the mosque also apply to these shrines and religious centers?
Well, based on my understanding of the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani, he's of the view that it's not permissible to make the shrines of the imams impure. And the same rules, most of the rules, not exactly the same rules, most of the rules which apply to a mosque or to a masjid apply to the shrines of the imams as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a slight difference. For example, some women might wonder as to whether they are allowed to enter the shrines when they are not allowed to enter a mosque, for example,
yes,
or stay in a mosque. Of course, Ayatollah Sistani says that it is permissible for menstruating women to enter the shrines of the imams and stay in one of the courtyards and to engage in dua or supplications. But for example, if you go to the holy city of Mashhad and you visit the shrine of Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, you see that there are porches, there are courtyards. Of course, menstruating women can enter those courtyards.
Yes.
But but it's not permissible for a menstruating woman to enter the room where the chamber is located. Yeah, mm-hmm. is located, but elsewhere, except for, because if you go to the shrine, also you will see that there are mosques inside the shrine.
Yes.
Mosques
in, so and again, in those places, they are not allowed.
And, again, of course, it's not permissible for a woman who gets her period to enter those places which are dedicated as mosques or which are used as mosques.
Mm-hmm.
And but when it comes to purifying,
yes.
to making these places impure, of course, it's not permissible to make the shrines of the imams impure.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Javed, if you agree, let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion and rules, religious laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Stay tuned.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javed, is still in the studio with us talking about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Sheikh Javed, is it permissible to take ritually impure objects with you into a mosque? We know that to make usually the interior part of the mosque impure is haram and unlawful. It's not permissible. But what about entering these objects, like impure objects, into a mosque? Is it permissible to do so?
Let's also differentiate between najis objects and things which are essentially impure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? For example, blood is essentially impure. Feces, urine, wine, these things are essentially impure.
Uh-huh.
But let's say now your cloth is not essentially impure. It is. It has been made impure as a result of coming in contact with something impure. Okay.
Yes.
Now we have to understand the difference between taking a najis object,
mm-hmm.
things which have been made najis, but they are not essentially najis
impure,
or impure.
Yes.
Like, for example, a piece of garment which has been made impure, it is permissible to take it into a mosque. It's in, or it's also permissible to go into a mosque with a hand stained with blood. Okay, with a part of your body stained with blood, there is no problem, but to take, let's say, a bowl of blood into the mosque, or to take some human excretion
mm-hmm.
into the mosque,
mm-hmm.
or let's say a container of urine into the mosque, is absolutely forbidden because they are essentially impure. Or to take a glass of wine into the mosque is essentially, it is haram, and it is not allowed for anyone to take these essentially impure things into the mosque.
But you know, some nurses and doctors, in fact, sometimes use these religious centers, such as the mosque or including the mosque, as blood transfusion centers. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And you said that blood is essentially impure.
And you said that if there is a stain of blood on your, for example, skin, you
it's
can...
It's permissible.
It's permissible. But a bowel of blood, but you are talking about like packages of
yes.
blood here, right? Like blood transfusion taken from one person and transfused into another person. Or for the sake of God, for the sake of humanitarian purposes. Yeah, that's something else. You know, bags... containing plastic bags. Yeah, plastic bags filled with human blood and used for transfusion. Yes. Of course, that's a secondary rule, you know. It's a secondary rule. Uh-huh. Long time ago, for example, when it was not possible to get the blood transfused, okay, yes. into another person's body, mm-hmm. It could have been forbidden to carry blood into a mosque. But at this time around, when blood can be sold, in the long time ago, it was not permissible to sell blood because yes. haram things are not permissible to sell or to buy, uh-huh. like wine, like human excrement. But blood at this time can be it's permissible to sell and to buy because it can be transfused and it can be used for rational. Purposes, and therefore it is a secondary rule. There's no objection to someone taking blood for transfusion into a mosque, okay, into the mosque campus. Not, of course, you are not going to take it into mihrab or the places where people usually offer prayers. There could be a special place dedicated for this purpose. But even then, the blood is not going to spread. It's good. It is going to be transfused into somebody's veins. Yes. And therefore, it does not mean disrespect. It does not amount to disrespect. You said it is essentially impermissible to sell an essentially impure thing like blood.
Yeah,
of course, in the past, but not now. But what about dogs? Because dogs could also be like essentially impure.
Dogs are not allowed to take into a mosque, you know?
No. I'm talking about selling.
Yeah.
Them.
Yes. Yeah.
Like we have shepherd dogs. We
yeah,
have
course.
Like these kinds of dogs, which are used like for rational purposes,
yeah,
like for
course.
A shepherd to guard the sheep
of
or
course,
the herd of the sheep,
Sistani.
Right?
Ayatollah Sistani says that it is permissible to buy or sell a dog for this purpose. A guard dog.
But not a pig.
Not a guard dog.
Yes.
Not a pig,
uh-huh.
of course.
Yeah.
A guard dog is a dog which is supposed to protect a campus or, let's say, a farm or a property.
Yes.
Against thieves, against any threats. And, of course, it's permissible to buy such things.
Uh-huh.
And the same is the case with, let's say, marijuana, okay?
Uh-huh.
Marijuana is haram.
Yes.
Know? But if it is useful for a purpose,
for medication,
yes. for medical treatment, it is permissible to buy it,
mm-hmm.
to have a form of marijuana and sell it
mm-hmm.
to people or to doctors, provided that it's prescribed by a doctor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
minutes.